This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. This is Nate G, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, can you hear me okay? My audio has had a little bit of trouble.
Yes, your audio is a little choppy, and we're just going to have to see how it goes. Everything
okay.
Good here?
Well, we will see how it goes.
Is this better?
Let's see. Keep talking. Tell me a story. How are you feeling about your Dodgers? They're in trouble tonight.
Yeah, they are in trouble. It's 5-1 last time I checked. And so we'll see how this goes.
I'm saving you from having to watch the Astros celebrate. There you go. There you go. Always out looking out for your interests.
Unbelievable. The best friend I could ever hope for.
There you go. All right. Yeah, your audio sounds okay for the moment. I think we're all right.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about some listener questions that have to do with borderline personality disorder, multiple personality, obsessive compulsive. We have a question from one of our listeners about an episode of erectile dysfunction he had and maybe the anxiety associated with it. He's trying to figure out why. But before that, I was sent an article. I was reading it on Facebook, and the article is titled "What to Say to Little Kids Instead of Say Sorry." And the context of the article is this author. She is talking about how she visited a playground at a kindergarten, and she saw a little boy accidentally stepped on this little girl's finger. And the boy went up to the girl, looked in the eye, and instead of saying sorry, he said, "Are you okay? Can I get you a wet towel?" And she was crying, but she shook her head no, and then after her tears went away, they went back to playing. And so to this author, she saw this, and it was saying that we shouldn't make kids say sorry, and that sorry to her is essentially a way out, that if you teach a kid to say sorry for anything, then it's like a little hit and run driver where you just say sorry, you let it go, and then now you can just move on. So her whole article is about telling people to just say to ask what they can do and be empathetic and bring them together, and she has a whole list of steps. What was interesting, Dr. Lyle, is when I sent you this article, say, "Hey, what do you think about this article?" Do you remember what you replied to me?
I don't know what I said. I thought it was ludicrous, but I don't know what I said.
I asked you, "Is interesting article? What do you think for the show?" And you said, "Great article for you to read, and then I'll bash it."
That sounds about right. Yeah, this is sort of typical of people that are thinking that you are teaching children characteristics, and this is just gross ignorance. And of course, she's got whoever wrote this article. I assume it's a female. That's who's interested in the childhood little issues of children and their little developmental processes. And this is just ridiculous. You don't teach your children morality. You don't have to instruct it. You don't have to do anything. They will quickly learn what is appropriate in the social environment. Saying you're sorry is totally legitimate. Let's talk about why. I hadn't even thought about it till now, but let's think about this. If you step on somebody's finger and you say you're sorry, That's actually very important communication that comes naturally to people. It's basically saying, "I see that I have done something to hurt you, but it was not my intention. And since it wasn't my intention, you don't have to worry that it's going to continue and that it's going to escalate." Okay? That's extremely serious information, extremely important information, and totally natural, because people are aware that they bump into people, that there's accidental contact between individuals in various dimensions, that we can offend, we can bump into physically. You can imagine what a difference it is if you have an auto accident and you get out of your car and you're like, God, I'm so sorry, as opposed to, hey, I'm not sorry. Like, wow, big difference. And so the idea that sorry isn't enough and that it's a blank check, you know what I mean, is just a completely stupid. So this is an example of some brilliant social engineering on somebody's part, saying, oh, no, we're going to go above and beyond and really train these super citizens who will not just say sorry, but instead we're going to bypass that communication and go right to, you know, what you can do to help the situation. Ludicrous, okay? The truth is that human beings will figure that out naturally in their own good time, to the extent that their intelligence and maturity and personality will cause them to make those appropriate empathic inferences. And that is that. So the whole notion that we're going to coach, teach, et cetera, and make a difference in young people's characters is just sheer stupidity. But, you know, what are you going to do? Such is life in the era. You know, the truth is that there are many, many reasons for this misunderstanding. And, you know, I can just – you hear my frustration. I'm really not particularly frustrated with the author of this article. It's just some pop writer that thinks that they've learned something deep and important and that they've seen something fascinating and you know, important. No, the truth of the matter is that the fault of this lies with courses throughout the United States in developmental psychology and social psychology, et cetera. And the academic psychology is still laden up to its gills in learning theory. But there are reasons for this, and some of the reasons are legitimate, and some of them are disgusting. And both are at play here. So I don't want to give listeners the idea that I'm just completely and thoroughly disgusted with anybody that ever makes this kind of inferences about human nature. I'm not. I'm frustrated. Well, my frustration is – so let me first explain why we're in this mess. Learning theory began truly with Ivan Pavlov, and Pavlov had fantastic insights and experimentation that really ushered in a whole new way of thinking about the brain. So through classical conditioning was a great discovery. And certainly other people had talked about associative learning. I mean, that goes back for a long time. But no one had any data and no one really had a feel for this until Pavlov had run his experiments with the dogs and digestion and hitting the bell. And so that ushered in a tremendous amount of research. And then 30 years later, 40 years later, B.F. Skinner comes along with operant conditioning and really takes it to a whole new level. And so behind truly grand discoveries in classical conditioning and operant conditioning, psychologists really did feel like this was the way of the world. This is how the mind works. And I know I've probably said this before, but man, I'm going to say it again. Because it's directly germane to my disgust with this article that you're just talking about. And that is that that Skinner, by putting a pigeon in the cage or a rat in a cage, and then you put them in a cage and they press a little bar, and they only get a pellet if they do something right before that you want them to do. So they spin to the left or they spin to the right or they get up on their hind legs or flap their wings or flap the left wing or flap the right wing, et cetera. In other words, by reinforcing with food precisely what it is that you want done, you wait for them to do a behavior that you want that's So, for example, if it's spinning to the left, you wait until they move to the left a little bit, and then, boom, you present them with food. And what will happen is the organism then is sophisticated enough. It isn't thinking this thing through consciously. It just the brain literally will make that movement more than it will make the movement of spinning to the right. Because if the last thing, it did something, it doesn't know what it did that caused the food to come, but it's going to spin to the left more likely than it's going to spin to the right if the last time it spun to the left, food appeared. And so then you do it again. And then it'll start spinning to the left some more, and then you do it again. And then you let it spin, but you, instead of waiting until it spins 30 degrees, you wait until it spins 40 degrees, and then you feed it. And you keep doing this, and then pretty soon you can get this thing spinning in a circle. And so the learning theorists, this is called shaping. And so by being able to shape behavior in any way that they wanted with these animals, they, of course, then made the inference that this is why animals do what they do. They came up with the inference out of this that essentially if you got an animal from the day it was born and you then were in charge of what we're going to call the reinforcement contingencies, in other words, you reinforce certain behaviors and you did not reinforce others, then you would say, well, that is why that animal is doing something. If we could get control of its environment and we could get control of the reinforcement schedules, we will be able to program that thing's behavior. We will be able to predict and control its behavior. Well, the fact that they can do that in a cage and make it be truth was extremely impressive to behaviorists and psychology in general, academic psychology. And, of course, on the other side of the equation, you've got the Freudian saying, look, this has nothing to do with humans. Humans, it's all about, you know, what happened in the Oedipal stage, the conflict between the father and the son and penis and everything else under the sun. So they're completely out to lunch in a whole different area of the field. But the learning theorists are actually right in the heart of objective science, and their achievements were impressive. But what they did not understand and they did not appreciate at all was they did not appreciate that animals came into the game with a phenomenal amount of pre-programmed decision-making. This is what they didn't understand. So they didn't understand you cannot condition a cat to act like a rat. You can condition both of them to spin to the left, but you're not going to condition one of them to meow, and you're not going to have them stretch the way a cat would stretch, and you're not going to be able to condition that rat to chase a string. But you never have to condition the cat to chase a string. It'll do it from the first time it can open its eyes. And so the behaviorist basically ignored, because it was inconvenient and it was way too complicated, and it went a place that they didn't have really the intellectual courage or chops to understand what they were looking at. They did not understand that the organism comes, of course, with the ability to learn, which is very important to understand. But more than anything, it comes pre-programmed with a phenomenal amount of downloaded, pre-programmed, essentially value judgment systems. This they did not understand at all. And that lack of understanding, it permeates the academic thinking in psychology all the way to clinical psychology. And so so learning theory, the idea that you essentially learn to be a human, that you're going to learn your morality, that you're going to learn a better way to talk to somebody when you've stepped on their finger, this is ludicrous. This is essentially thinking that we shape these people by reinforcement into being good little people, as opposed to the idea that they're a human being, and if they're born a human being, they're born with natural empathic mechanisms that are actually part and parcel of the existing system, that it's already in the system to be this way. And you have to learn the specific words to communicate the thing that you have to learn the words of that specific linguistic culture So you don't have to learn to feel sorry and to say I'm sorry, but you have to, in other words, your brain already knows what it is that you're supposed to communicate in deep nonverbal algorithms. It already knows it. So the but what you have to learn is you have to learn to spit it out in English, okay, or in Chinese or in Hebrew or whatever language is that you happen to speak locally. So that, though, is absolutely not taught. Okay, this is the feeling and the action of apology and the reason for the apology. These are shaped through evolutionary time as the natural neural circuits of humanity. And so this writer and people, then whoever is the teacher at that school or the counselor that's invoking this ludicrous program of teaching the children to be more this or that way morally, is just completely wasting everybody's time. And self-aggrandizing scheme all behind learning theory, and it's all ludicrous. So that's why, so you know what? I didn't even intend to say anything about this thing. And we now spend 15 minutes blasting it. But it deserves to be blasted, not that these poor people, these poor saps that are uneducated trying to do this thing, but essentially my ire is for the very often throughout the history of psychology in the 20th century, the lack of intellectual honesty and courage on the part of scientists deep in the system in learning theory that did not and would not acknowledge that their theory had a massive gaping hole and that it in fact is essentially fundamentally wrong. And that they need a huge overhaul. And that overhaul is evolutionary psychology. And evolutionary psychology is the correct view. This always disturbs people that are more open-minded, and they have a hard time believing that there's such a thing as a correct view and an incorrect view. There can only be one objectively correct view of psychology. All other views are wrong to varying degrees. Evolutionary psychology is the correct view from which to view psychology. That doesn't mean that there won't be debates, battles, empirical questions, a lot of investigation to actually figure out what evolutionary psychology is. But the fact that evolutionary psychology is the correct view is really not in any realistic dispute. The evolutionary psychology is the realization that the mind and its operations were shaped by evolution, and they were shaped by evolution in a particular fashion. There are human universals to the motivational and psychological and emotional architecture of human beings that are human universals. In the same way that you have a Gray's anatomy of the body, that you can learn medicine and anatomy and physiology at UCLA, and it doesn't matter where you go on earth, you are a qualified doctor. If you understand that anatomy and physiology, you don't have to learn Aboriginal physiology to be able to operate effectively on those peoples. You know what it is because around the world, all humans are anatomically effectively identical. Of course, with moderate individual differences that exist not only within gene pools but between gene pools as well. But there is a universal physical architecture of humans, and there is a universal psychological architecture of humans. And that architecture, just as the physical architecture was shaped by evolution, so is the psychological architecture. Learning theory basically says, no, there is no universal psychological architecture of humans. What there is a blank slate, and we learn through reinforcement what it is that we are and what it is we become and how moral we are and whether or not we learn to say, what can I do instead of I'm sorry, and that changes our psychology like hell it does. Okay?
And yeah, but so it makes humans seem really intelligent. They can learn everything in just a few years.
Yes. Actually, Tubby and Cosmides and Steven Pinker and others have shown that it's actually would be impossible. It's actually literally impossible. You can't possibly learn to be a human. You have to know too much. There would be, for example, a young child will point at a cup and you'll say cup, and it knows intuitively that you don't mean the color, and you don't mean the handle, and you don't mean the hole in the middle. You mean the whole. You mean the whole thing. That you would be impossible for you to learn language if you did not already come pre-programmed with the knowledge that when you point to something and mom says cup, that she means the whole thing. That is a phenomenally important instinct. Okay? Mm-hmm. Without that instinct, you could not learn language. It would be impossible. It would be too difficult for you to ever figure out what the hell they were talking about. So there are a tremendous amount of instincts that make up what human nature is. And let me tell you, you don't learn to be a human. You just are one. All right. Let's move on, see if we got some questions.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue to talking about these little individual differences that we have. But I have one really quick question, follow-up question about this. And that is saying sorry too often, does that make people perceive someone as weaker or careless?
Well, if you're saying sorry, well, I mean, it depends on why. So a person that may be clumsy may be making a lot of mistakes and having to say I'm sorry a lot. And other people may perceive that it's like, hey, well, if you're sorry so much, how come you aren't more careful? You know what I'm saying? And so they're going to start getting irritated and feeling like you may have the empathy to understand that you're screwing up, but you're not seemingly having enough chops to figure out how to avoid it. You know what I mean? So saying I'm sorry is not a blank check. It immediately gives you the benefit of the doubt, and it will give you the benefit of the doubt quite often. But obviously, if it's overused over and over again, then people are going to get frustrated. That's if you're making mistakes. Now, what if someone is essentially being unbelievably submissive? Then they're essentially trying to any little thing that they're sorry that they didn't pick up all the people's trash. They're sorry that they didn't clean up the lunchroom. They're sorry, et cetera. People can read what that is. That's a very scared person worried about getting kicked out of the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And so people pick up on that too, and that is definitely a potential sign of weakness. So and that will not be mistreated by reasonable people, but it will also potentially be exploited by others. And so that's part of the price of having a little bit of a distorted nervous system that may be essentially overly agreeable and overly conscientious.
Okay. All right. So we're going to move on to these questions. Excellent. So perfect segue to all the little individual differences. And our first question is about borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
All right. So this listener is actually describing borderline personality disorder and asking saying, is borderline personality a mental illness or simply an undesirable personality where the affected individual has extreme disagreeable, emotionally unstable, and low in conscientiousness? She's asking because her mother-in-law has borderline personality disorder, and I feel like she's ruining my husband's life. When he interacts with her, he becomes physically and mentally ill with headaches, digestion difficulties, and depression and anxiety. Her outrageous and disgusting behavior puts both of us in bad moods and has strained our relationship and robbed us of much of life's joys. Done some reading on borderline personality disorder and understand that her specific type is the waif borderline. She's constantly playing the helpless victim card and shows no desire to develop any healthy habits or seek therapy. She's deceptive, manipulative, throws temper tantrums, and then uses threats of self-harm and suicide to get her way. The intensity of this situation is heightened as my husband is helping her move into a new home and community to facilitate the ideal circumstances for her to live a healthy and happy life. But we both realize that changing her environment will not fix her. My husband's more involved than I would like, but he says he needs to do this for his own conscience. I'm respectful and sympathetic because his father committed suicide a few years ago, and he continues to live with the guilt that he did not do enough to stop it. And he tells me that he'll be pulling back his involvement once she's settled into this new home. But at this point, I'm ready to have no contact with her, and he's getting pretty close to that as well. I've always held my tongue and let him deal with these issues, but I've reached my limit. What are your thoughts?
Oh, my. What a question. Let's see. I think we're going to begin with the notion of is this a, quote, mental illness or an undesirable personality characteristic? I'm not really sure of the difference in most cases when people talk about personality disorders. There really isn't any difference. You can call it a mental illness if you want. That's extremely convenient for psychiatry, because then there's some pill that somebody made up that's supposed to help it, which is of course not true. The mental illness, I don't consider an anxiety disorder mental illness. I don't even consider depression a mental illness. Bipolar disorder I consider a mental illness, and schizophrenia I consider a mental illness. Not because there's anything that we can do. Anyway, the long and short of it is there's people that have some circuits that are resulting in very distorted views of reality. And to the extent that those distorted views of reality are crippling, then we can, if we want, we can call this a, quote, mental illness. The particularly when we feel like it is innate to the system, and that there may be no possible way to change it or significantly influence it, which is usually the case at this point in history. So borderline personality disorder, this is not some illness as a result of some virus that eats up somebody, part of somebody's brain. This is a very undesirable personality. I wasn't aware that they had, quote, waif type versus probably the aggressive type, I'm sure, is the other one. Borderlines are very disagreeable and emotionally unstable. That's what it is that you're seeing. It's a combination of those two characteristics. And I don't have data for this, but I effectively believe that it's a much more female-oriented look at that combination. I think females tend to want to be connected and invited and included and be part of the pack. Males are more desirous of being the head of the pack. Disagreeable and unstable in males is more likely to be considered narcissism. And so I think it's actually very similar genetically to narcissistic personality disorder. I think it's manifesting itself a little different in female. The vast majority of borderlines are females, incidentally. So anyway, that's what it is. Very disagreeable, very emotionally unstable, not fixable. And so the solution is to get as far from these people as you can. The husband, it sounds like he had a father who is, had his own tough situation. And the son sounds like a saint, and he is, has obviously incredible patience to trying to take care of his mother and getting her settled and so on and so forth. You want to do this. It's not the borderline's fault that they are hell on wheels. They didn't ask for this. They are essentially raw nervous systems that feel like that others are not treating them fairly. They're totally puzzled as to why this is, and they're incredibly upset. And so they're just basically living in a hell of a lot of psychological pain. The fact that they inflict this pain on others is, fair. In other words, they're just another organism out there. Essentially, think of it as a rabid dog. In other words, we might shoot that rabid dog in the middle of our driveway because that's the reasonable thing for us to do, and that it seems reasonable for all concerned. But to the rabid dog, it doesn't seem that way. This is not to say I can now hear a complaint to the Board of Psychology. But I said that we should. No, please keep it in context. The truth is that a borderline, and all borderlines are not the same. They are very different. It's not that they have a couple of types. They have, infinite ranges of variation, as all people do. And so so when we label them as a borderline, this is just a convenient way to encapsulate this more generalized idea that these are very disagreeable and very unstable people. And they suffer. And people around them suffer, and people that care about them suffer, and people that are under their psychological force. For one reason or another, their children, or this is no day at the beach having a borderline mother. And it's no day on the beach having a borderline mother when you're a kid, and it's no day at the beach when you're an adult and they're an adult. And so what you want to do is you want to humanely as possible get your life as much divorced from their life as you possibly can. And this is an ultimate example of what I call the disagreeable distance. If you think about disagreeable people and yourself and the relationships with them that you are in, think of in terms of Venn diagrams, circle A and circle B. If you must be interacting with them, you want that intersection to be as small as possible. And ideally, no intersection, but, there's times when this gal here can have the intersection be unbelievably minimal, and the husband is going to have it just a little bit more. And but certainly, drawing lines, drawing boundaries, and keeping boundaries firm, this is a problem with this, is that the borderlines will escalate into a crisis, and you will feel like you must step in and solve that crisis. But when you do, you reinforce that behavior. And so we have to have some simple solutions sometimes for borderlines, like if they're going to threaten suicide, it's like, well, you know who to call, and it's not me. Okay? So if you call me again, I'm not going to talk to you until you tell me your location, and then I will be calling 911 for you. Oh, no, don't do that. Okay, well, then fine. The next time this phone rings and you're on the other end of it and you're telling me you might kill yourself, that's what I'm going to do. So I'm just warning you that that's what's going to happen. Okay? I care about you, but that is what is the right thing for me to do. Done. Okay? And you have to, and then if they call back and they start whining, you call 911. I've called 911 more than once with personality disorders and have them go through the embarrassment of the cops banging on their door and taking them outside and blah, 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 blah. Oh, no problem. I've had people hauled away and hauled down to the county and held for a while, et cetera. Too bad. Okay, this is, you punish me with your personality disorder, I'm going to make sure that I sleep at night and I know that I did, you cried wolf and I responded. And that's how it's going to be, okay? And so that's what you do. That's how you set the boundaries. And you sleep at night, you keep the boundaries up, and you don't reinforce any of the crazy crap, and you get your life as far, as little interaction as you could possibly get. That's how you handle that. All right, let's go on to the next.
All right, we got another question. We've got a caller on hold just for a couple of minutes. So you want to go over the multiple personality question first and then take the caller, or you want to take the caller first?
Let's take multiple pretty quick. That should be fast.
Okay, so dear Dr. Lyle, I've always suspected multiple personality disorder was simply a tactic used by narcissists to manipulate people. For example, the angry personality arises in response to being told to do something that the person doesn't want to do. What are your thoughts on this? And a follow-up question will be after.
Okay. At this point in my career, I don't believe that there is such a thing as a multiple personality disorder. I don't believe there's ever been such a thing. I believe that there's been very funny-looking pathologies. You've got temporal lobe epilepsy. That can look really weird. You can have some very strange things happening. But the notion of multiple personality disorder, people might have to read about this. I read that that the people that invented this, some psychiatrist that said that he, in mid-20th century, that he had seen such a thing, got famous, and then late in his life, when he was like 93 years old, he recanted and said he made up the whole thing. Apparently, like, this hadn't ever been found in the literature until he, quote, discovered it, and has made him famous and all this sort of jazz. So I think I'm telling this story right. I don't really see how this type of process that people are suggesting exists could ever evolve. Doesn't make any sense to me. I've had psychologists, all a bunch of mediocre people, said that they've seen one. This is like a badge of courage, or, you know, it's kind of like coming back from the war and you got a medal of honor. You know, like, I've seen two multiples. Wow, let me tell you a story. There's all kinds of narcissistic people out there. There's all kinds of there's schizophrenics that are very odd, that will have very odd dialogue, et cetera. So there's a lot of strange people and unusual pathology out there. But multiple personality disorder, I believe, is a fiction. And you know, probably somewhere somebody will call me up and say, oh, no, my sister was a multiple. You know, fine. You know, I've heard it all. I have seen thousands of humans. I've seen people who were sort of bluffing multiple in the criminal justice system. One of the most famous cases of theoretical multiple personality disorder was Kenneth Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler in Los Angeles, and I believe in the 1970s. Bianchi and his cousin Angelo Bono, I think it was, murdered some people, and then they got caught, and then Bianchi, basically sold some psychologists that he was a multiple. And oh boy, did they eat that up. And the cops knew, the district attorney knew that their case was going in the toilet behind this, because the psychologists were all buying this and they're all excited about it and reporting to each other how many multiples they'd seen. And this was going to make them famous, because, you know, they were the psychologists who figured out that Kenneth Bianchi was a multiple. You know, this is the whole, there was some movie with Richard Gere and Ed Norton about the same almost a remake of the Hillside Strangler case, same notion of the guy pretending he's a multiple, and then it turns out he's just a sociopath. Well, Kenneth Bianchi was just a sociopath, and so the prosecution called in one of the great psychologists of the 20th century, Martin Orne, out of the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Orne very easily trapped Kenneth Bianchi. It was trivial to do this. Stuck information about what a multiple is like under Bianchi's nose, and in other words, you know, gave him basically false data on what that was like, and then Bianchi immediately starts manifesting the characteristics. It was hilarious to watch this. It was literally child's play for Martin Orne to make a shambles of this case. So, given the fact that about how eager psychologists are to diagnose this, I don't trust anybody. I've never seen anything even remotely like it. I've certainly seen odd pathology, but I've seen many, many psychotic people with very bizarre personalities. But I have never seen anything that is a multiple, and quite frankly, I can't, like I said, understand how such a thing would ever be constructed. So, I think it's bogus.
Okay.
All right.
Fantastic.
Let's go on to – oh, we got a caller.
Yeah, we got a caller. All right.
Okay.
Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? And welcome to the show.
Hey, Nate and Dr. Lowell, can you hear me?
Yes,
yes.
I can.
Hey, it's Rob. Sorry your Dodgers lost. I know I don't know how the Stone Age brain is taking that, but
well, I don't really watch soccer, so it's, you know, it's not that bad for me.
Very good. Okay. All right. What's up, Rob?
Well, I think I have a pretty juicy question, but
okay.
So, you know, Dr. Lyle is a vegan who just a few weeks ago on the show, when asked about living in a commune, said that's hippie nonsense and communism and socialism are bad ideas. So, I mean, this is classic Doug Lyle and shows how brilliant he is because he sees the intelligence in, you know, eating like a vegan diet, McDougal style, True North style diet, whatever, to avoid heart disease. But at the same time, he's saying your commune stuff is hippie nonsense and, you know, communism, socialism, bad ideas. So, and, you know, you recommend a book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by a libertarian, which, you know.
Yeah.
So it's I'm wondering if you could, since you easily debunk everything else, just like you did in the show, you debunk all this stuff in psychology, pop psychology, and say it's all nonsense.
Yeah.
Could you give a brief, like, overview of your basic political philosophy to just demolish people's stupid political opinions, or, you know.
All right, we'll do that. I guess that'll be our final question. The issue is that I've described this before on a previous podcast, probably last a year ago when we were talking about we're talking more about politics. And so I described the nature of politics and its evolution. So what you have fundamentally is you have a political problem, and the political problem of human beings is to negotiate the fact that there are benefits to living in groups and there are also costs. And so the problem, the political problem is, how do we optimize the benefits and minimize the costs? That is the problem. And it's going to turn out that a major portion of that problem is going to be economics. And the reason why that's true is that animal behavior is going to be directed at securing resources and protecting resources in order to survive and reproduce. So what the fundamental problem of life is the problem of the transformation of energy into DNA. So for plants, they just sit there and they take in the solar energy. If another plant comes and overgrows them and takes their sun, too bad for you. Okay, there's nothing you can do about it. But if you're an animal, what you have is a brain, and a brain is attached to muscles, and those muscles can now move you. So you have a sensory system that brings in information, and it will give you data about both opportunities and threats in the environmental space so that you can then move or contract muscles in a way to put yourself in a position to optimize your opportunities and minimize your threats. And those opportunities and threats are all directly related to gene survival. So the job of the organism is to actually move most economically in ways that will ultimately reproduce DNA. So the animal, of course, has no insight into this, and neither do humans. It doesn't make any difference. The truth of the matter is that's how they're shaped by evolution to be very efficient at this. So human beings figured out, as many animals have figured out, that there is a advantage to being in groups. There are also conflicts. And so political process in humans and in chimpanzees and in other animals is to deal with the fact that this is not all going to be harmonious, that there are going to be problems as a result of group living. Now, for human beings, the problem ultimately, like I said, a great many of the problems of human cohabitation are going to involve economics. And so one of the great values of living in a group is that you can essentially reduce the risk of being an isolated individual by pooling resources. In other words, we're going to all join in and produce resources, then we're going to share them. So we essentially become an insurance pool. So the very same process that leads to State Farm insurance on your car is exactly the very same process that led human beings to be a group-oriented animal. Now, so it's going to turn out that within a communal sharing of the situation where we go out there and try to grab energy, i.e. food, from the environment and also put in a certain amount of energy to protect our resources, i.e. let's make sure our children don't get eaten and that we don't get eaten. These kinds of problems are going to result in essentially rules that are going to be that are going to come up. And so animals have instinctual rules, and human beings have many instinctual rules. I.e., you step on my foot, you say I'm sorry, okay? Unless you meant to step on my foot, at which point we got a big problem. Now, so what's going to happen is that that in situations where the food supply is going to be highly variable, it's going to be much more conducive to everybody's survival to have more sharing. And when the food supply is going to be extremely stable, it's going to be more conducive for people to not share. So it's going to turn out that early man in situations where they were literally ensuring each other for survival and hunting would have been a highly variable resource. So some people in the tribe could have starved to death while other people had a bounty by using a communistic sort of a situation, partially communistic situation. They wind up with everybody better off. Now, even in those situations, we find today that when we study those people, we find that there is that the people who are the most effective in hunting, those people are irritated with the people who are less effective. They are irritated at the fact that they are essentially subsidizing the less competent. We find the less competent are irritated with the attitude of the people who are more competent, and they consider them stingy, because there's always a fight over who gets the most and who gets the best cut, et cetera, et cetera. So this is very much the kind of problems that you're always going to have whenever you essentially have a union. So if you have a union and everybody's getting paid the same, there's people that are producing more and people that are producing less, and there's some irritation, you know, over this issue. This is a problem fundamentally with communism. So communism is a big problem because it's conceptually the idea that we're all going to basically divide things up equally completely disincentivizes individuals to try to make the most of their movements and to try to be as efficient and effective as they can personally be. The pure capitalism, on the other hand, basically says we're not going to share anything, we're not insuring anybody, et cetera. And this is going to be a situation that is potentially problematic because you're going to have problems when you get that extreme that are going to start disturbing a lot of people. And so that's going to have it's going to have its own stability challenges. So this is why it's going to turn out that there is no actually correct place on a dimension where on the far left of a line we could call it pure communism, and on the far right of the line we could call it pure capitalism. In other words, the dimension here is share on the left and not share on the right. The share not share dynamic is going to be somewhere along that line is going to be the optimal place for a given society at a given place and time with a given talent, energy, circumstances, etc. And to a lot of my libertarian friends, they think that the correct place is always on the right, very far right side of the line. And to my communistic friends, of which I have few, the idea is that the correct place is on the far left side of the line. I will submit that there is not a correct place on the line. The correct place can only be judged in the context of what the variance situation is with respect to particularly survival resources. So I give an example that if you are a bunch of Englishmen on a boat in the Antarctic and your ship called Endurance is frozen in the ice since 1912, and you are trying to get the hell out of there and survive, then it's going to turn out that if you're on a little boat sailing in those waters, hoping to hit St. George's Island in a 1,000 miles of open ocean, of the roughest ocean in the world, and you've got 8 people on that boat, one of them is great at the sextant, and one of them is great fishing, one of them is tremendous at the oars, one of them is outstanding as a sailing. If you 8 Englishmen interdependent on that boat and every single one of them is absolutely, you know, we don't know which one is going to be the most important because we don't know what we're going to be facing in the next 15 minutes. If the fisherman catches a fish and three other guys were also fishing at the same time and the best fisherman catches the fish, the right way to divide the fish isn't eight equal parts. It's actually from each according to his ability to each according to his need. So even if I caught that fish, what I really want is I want to divide that fish in a way that optimizes the statistical likelihood of all people surviving. It doesn't do me a damn bit of good to make to eat my fill and have any one of those guys get into trouble because I don't know which one is going to be critical for my survival. This is the checkmate to straight laissez-faire capitalism. And this is why this species didn't evolve a straight laissez-faire capitalism psychology. This species actually evolved under conditions much more like pure communism than it did pure capitalism, but it's actually somewhere in the middle. And it's going to turn out that I think a problem that the world has today politically is that we've got a lot of the Stone Age brain has a lot of communistic circuits in it. It's not fair that somebody has more that disturbs people. But at the same time, we live in a world with actually very consistent resources for food so that in the United States, nobody's hungry. If you're hungry in the United States, you don't have any help getting down to the food bank because there's plenty of food there. Okay, so people are needy in other ways, but they're not needy for that. And the extreme neediness is far less than it has been in decades past. And it's getting, of course, better by the day as technology and economic capability get greater and greater. I'm not saying that there isn't some serious need and some legitimate poverty. There is. But it's not at the same level that it was in 1960. And so what's fading over the horizon is the anxiety about literal survival. And so now a laissez-faire capitalist position looks more and more defensible and basically says, look, we don't need to be so worried about sharing. In fact, it seems to me like the right thing to do is to not share at all. This is still not true. We do not live in a situation where all of this is even, you know, that it's easy enough for every individual to access what they need for even basic survival. If you're a deaf, dumb, blind schizophrenic without a good mother, you're in trouble, and you're going to need help. And it would be absurd to construct a society as wealthy as this one without some sharing. So a libertarian position would say, well, we should do it all privately and nobody should be taxed, et cetera. This starts to be gets to the level of ridiculous. So my overarching political position is that our job is to figure out what is the optimal set of circumstances as best we can determine to try to figure out how to optimize people's happiness functioning in the society. That is likely going to be a limited constitutional government, not sharing a hell of a lot. Sharing is as much as we need to, but as little as necessary. This is very Jeffersonian in its view. It's the notion that there's an underlying principle that underlines my political philosophy, which is that ultimately we want to maximize voluntary transactions between individuals. This is the maximization of freedom. And this simply makes intuitive sense to me, and it's interesting that a lot of people are very disturbed by this. They want to limit other people's freedoms for various and sundry reasons because those freedoms disturb them. This is, I think, a mistake. In other words, I think that I agree with, in this view, general view of the philosopher Sam Harris, and that is that there are superior, objectively superior political circumstances, and they're objectively inferior ones. And so this is ultimately could be in principle an empirical question if anybody was ever interested. And I think that we can already see that freer societies are both wealthier and the people are happier. That does not mean that everybody's really happy and everybody's really wealthy and everybody's happy about the situation, and that there isn't some disturbing problems that come as a result of sometimes the striking inequalities that result from a free society that can be striking. However, I still believe that in general that is the compass that you want to aim for. You want to aim for essentially the vision of Thomas Jefferson, which is the government that governs least governs best in general. We maximize transactions and freedom from individuals. We swallow the fact that that some people are going to be spectacularly wealthy and other people will be poor. But we want to make sure that we also, in that bounty and that wealth that is created by the ingenuity and the incentive and the protection of private property, we also want to make sure that we do enough sharing that we don't have people actually in trouble. And so that's my view of the thing, and I laugh at hippies in the commune because they are thinking, their hearts are in an interesting place. They are trying to be kind and wise, and they're trying to return to something simpler, which is all fine and a very interesting experiment for anyone to do and possibly a good one. But the notion that you're going to get 40 people on a few acres and that everybody's going to contribute equally and we're going to divide it equally is a riot. That is a fiasco. And the individuals that are going to try to create some little enclave of communistic nirvana are in for a rude awakening by about their fourth week. So that's simply not going to be consistent with human nature.
Wow. Rob, thank All you right. very much for the call, for the great question. Trying to get
question.
You on record, Dr. Lau, with your politics.
All right. I think that's enough for one night. I think we'll have to come back and answer all these other things next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.